Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Today, what you're going to hear is what we'll call a bit of a loosey-goosey presentation of what is a serious subject, a very serious subject. And I use the expression loosey-goosey, an expression that I encourage you to use wherever possible, because the show meanders quite a bit. It wound up incorporating a few topics that I didn't plan on discussing, but I thought they were useful in the moment during this stream of consciousness narrative that unfolded. So there is some stuff that I cut out of the show, and I took a couple of those clips and just tacked them on to the very end. Certainly not mandatory listening, might provide some insight, but wasn't really necessary, and I think kind of actually took away from the presentation. So they're there if you want to hear them. They're after a video presentation by Dr. Ross Green. You're going to hear the audio from that. You'll know a lot more about who he is 50 minutes from now. And the podcast began as I was trying to record my reaction to the following news clip.
It's not just embarrassing me, it's embarrassing them too, and I hope it does embarrass them as much as it's embarrassing me.
For about 2 hours at one of the busiest intersections in Palm Coast, teenager Jasmine was alternately defiant and devastated over what her parents call tough love.
That's not love, how the heck? That's not love.
Jasmine was forced to hold a big sign that says, I sneak boys in at 3 a.m. and disrespect my parents and grandparents. But parents Mike and Melinda say Jasmine's behavior's been on a downhill slide since starting high school in August. Lying, drinking, sneaking out.
I don't know what else to do. I've tried everything, and he says I'm babying her, so he's like, this is the next step to do for her, because I don't know. What do you do for the kids? I have no idea.
Mike says he lost hundreds of dollars taking the day off, but says if public humiliation doesn't get his stepdaughter's attention, Jasmine may come to the attention of police or worse.
The courts say to you, hey, why didn't you do some preventative stuff first? Or people look at you like that. This is our preventative stuff before the courts have to get involved. And because this is the beginning of what she's doing to eventually wind up in prison.
The sheriff's department did stop out here briefly, but they did not take any action. They say those are the girl's parents. They have a right to free speech. As long as they're not impeding traffic or doing anything else to violate the law, there's no problem here. But some passing motorists think the scarlet letter kind of sign, the community disgrace, could lead Jasmine to act out in other ways.
The way she looks right now, I don't want her to hurt herself, you know, going back to school and whatnot.
Others, however, approved of the punishment, supported unusual, very visual parenting.
Today is November 25th, and we're off to kind of a negative start here, really negative start here. And I'm hoping I can include some things over the next half hour that will turn this into a positive experience, certainly for me, but hopefully for you as well. Well, you know, when this first came to my attention this morning, I think I saw somebody sent this to me on Facebook. I looked at this, and my first instinct is find out who these people are, call them. I mean, that kind of that flash is what is in my mind, quite honestly, first of all. They should feel ashamed for this. It was like 2 minutes of that, where I'm like, that's the most ridiculous idea I could have. Because I would be doing pretty much exactly the same thing they are to them, and it would be drawing even more attention to this poor girl who does not want this attention. I'm sure would not benefit and would not appreciate anybody reaching out to her in a public way. I mean, like in a private way, it would probably be the best thing for her, you know, some empathy. But drawing more attention to this, I don't think would be good. You know, probably just wants to crawl under the covers. I couldn't even imagine how this feels. And this is a problem that we've talked about a lot on the show, even though this story not only exemplifies that problem, it also is that problem on steroids. This is absolutely outrageous, but not surprising. In fact, several of these stories came to my attention. People have sent me links to videos and articles, even just in the last year. This is not even the first time in Florida in the last 12 months that a parent has made their child stand out on an intersection with a sign to publicly shame them. The other example was the boy was getting bad grades, And we've even seen examples of this public shaming for your own good in social media. Like father shoots his daughter's laptop and then posts the video to YouTube. And similar occurrences on Facebook. So even with all the benefits of these new outlets, especially YouTube for young people, it seems like people who are stuck in that meme of might makes right, teach you a lesson for your own good, which is most parents and the state and the schools. There's ways to ruin those opportunities or turn them around and make them just as negative as they have the potential to be positive for young people. And they all tell the same story, like, oh, I was at the end of my rope, it's tough love. They all have the same rationalizations. But when you heard the mom in that clip, and I'll play just that part again.
I don't know what else to do. I've tried everything, and he says I'm babying her, so he's like, this is the next step to do for her, because I don't know. What do you do for the kids? I have no idea.
I think it becomes clear that this was not a last resort. Because, and yes, this show, because there's limited information on this family and for the girl involved, I think that's a good thing. So we do have to speculate a little bit. But based on what you see in those 2 minutes, you know this isn't a last resort because it doesn't even seem like there was a first resort or a second resort or any authentic effort, period, to deal with some of these issues. At least any effort that would have been a dramatic departure from the attitude and the taking advantage of the power disparity, might makes right, do this or else for your own good approach that we see in this video. It's hard to believe that people who would do something like this were at one point being compassionate and constructive, but that's just my take on it. You hear the father say, they'll ask us about preventative measures. And he says, that's what we're doing here. Now, that's interesting because one of the most punitive things that I can imagine that does not involve physical violence is being called preventative by dad or stepdad. But the problem is that we've been talking about for some time that all difficult and confrontational or potentially confrontational adult to teen or adult to child interactions, it seems like it is the rule. It is imperative. It is mandatory that you ignore the needs, the anxieties, the challenges of that young person. Root causes of behavior, that's taboo. Can't even go there. And here we see the most common and accepted approach for parents to try to solve problems. Remember, this doesn't solve anything. It only makes things worse, as it's certainly going to do in this situation for this Florida family. This is how the state approaches problems. This is certainly how the school approaches problems. And all three of those things work together nicely, don't they? To not solve problems and to keep, because of new problems, being invited to try the same methods to not solve more problems and so on and so forth. Never look at yourself. It's a challenging thing for all of us to do, you know, in our own lives, but it's so costly when adults won't do it. So costly for young people. Now, I've mentioned several times in the past that I spent a big chunk of my career working at a residential school. I worked with young people who had, quote unquote, behavioral challenges from the year 2000 until the year 2006 in two different locations, actually in many different locations for two different schools, both run by the same people. In the first experience, which lasted from 2000 to 2004, I spoke multiple times in the past about the remorse that I felt for some of the things in which I was involved. The last 2 years, I worked at another school where I felt like, you know, when it came to not just effective problem solving, but treating young people with some respect, I had kind of got my act together. I still made a lot of mistakes, you know, and this doesn't even include all the mistakes that I made in teaching, but I would often encounter situations. I would walk into situations where, oh boy, it felt like there was nothing I could do. Like there was no positive way forward in whatever that conflict was. And all that could be done was to walk it back. And that's very hard to do when emotions are high and I'm walking into other staff who are just exacerbating those negative emotions. And they're all just in this, you will do what I say mindset, which is going to go nowhere, especially with kids who are resistant to this forceful adult will that which just has consequences, you know, threats of consequences being fired at that person who's already under a tremendous amount of stress. And there was no way that I could diffuse that situation. And what I had to do several times was get the kid away from other adults. And maybe even a few times in my career, I was the adult, quite honestly, earlier on, that the kid needed to be gotten away from. But in 2004, in 2002, I was moved to this other campus, this special campus, where I was going to be the lead teacher. I took this job to earn the job that I really wanted, which was teaching history at this other school. So my attitude became very quickly, I can't have problems. I mean, this place always, this campus where I was the lead teacher, always had problems. And it, like, the attitude of both the students and the staff is, at the school, was this is where the worst kids go. And sometimes kids were sent to this campus to be punished. Now, it was never said, I'm sending you to, I'm not going to say the name of the campus, but I'm sending you to Campus V to punish you. But because Campus B was perceived to be more, you know, hands-on and intensive, it was like saying to the kid subtly, you need more supervision and you need less privileges, so you're going here until you get your act together. The school even did, I'm not making this up, the school even did the same thing with staff a couple of times that they wanted to get rid of. They wanted the staff to quit. I feel very, very strongly that that is true. So I took this job and I needed to prove myself. And I said, I can't have problems here. So for years, I had been kind of this grunt. You know, a couple of years I spent just working in the dorms and worked my way up into working during the school day, doing the outdoor education program, becoming a TA, and then asking for this job and getting it in 2002. So this was part of my very ambitious plan to transform this place from an environment where there always had to be these fires put out and there were always all of these administrators' eyes on what was going on there into a place that was just, you know, under control and nobody really had to worry about too much. Self-sufficient. And this was really, at the time, you know, this was really just about moving forward in my career, proving myself. This is when I was 24 years old. Now, I was only responsible for the day, and I had other people working there with me during the day, and then there would be a residential staff. We would switch at 3 o'clock, and they would run the campus until 11. So that was one of the most frustrating elements of this when I talk about, you know, having to get involved with issues between students and staff. It was usually the residential staff who, you know, I mean, this was a difficult job. This was a difficult place to work. This was in a Vermont town with not a lot of employment opportunities. And the school would give, you know, I mean, this was like, I think I started, my starting wage at this job was like $8 an hour when I was still in college working in the dorms. So they would give anybody a chance to try this job. So we had to deal with a lot of people who just weren't really equipped to do a job like this. And that also meant, and I know I've mentioned this before, dealing with people who really shouldn't have been around kids because they just seem to like this power disparity a little bit too much. You know, these kinds of positions, whether it be in law enforcement or foster care, tend to sometimes, not all the time, attract people like the opposite people to the ones who should be filling these roles. in addition to dealing with that, it was a lot of people not being on the same page, because we were trying to transform this program from a place where kids behaved either like, you know, completely out of control or like complete robots and not much in the middle. And I had the clinical team on my side. You know, the head clinician was a psychologist who wound up leaving the school after we transformed the program eventually. But it would feel like sometimes the work we would be able to do, the positive work that we could do with a kid in one day during school, would be undermined by some member of the residential staff in just one night. So that was frustrating. But the good thing for me was that this campus was isolated. It was 2 miles away from the rest of the school. So up until this point in my career, I felt like there was a standard way of doing things. And now that I didn't have all these eyes on me, I could try to do different things. So instead of doing things the way that I was supposed to do things from what I had observed going on everywhere else in the school, I needed to do things the way that I thought would solve problems. One of the reasons why I said I think we can get something positive out of this show, or at least I certainly can, is when I started to, I mean, I could only spend like 15 minutes looking at this horrible story from Florida or searching for more information about it. And I don't know what more info. I think we saw everything you need to see pretty much in 2 minutes, right? So I started to look at other things. Lisa from Tragedy and Hope, posted a video that Stefan Molyneux did with Dr. Ross Green called Stop Fighting with Your Kids. It was about a month old, so I watched that. And I read an article about Dana Martin. And I did some review on some nonviolent communication stuff that Wes had sent me. And I'll put a link to all of that in the show notes. And I was really happy to see that it was all lining up, right? It was all pretty consistent around, you know, focusing on the needs of young people. And I was really pleased because I always talk about all of these terrible mistakes I made in the past and how they affected people, that there was a point in my career where I had gotten my act together enough, where I was being thoughtful enough that I was doing things in a way that I think is helpful and respectful, even by my standards today. So this was maybe an hour and a half of exploration for me this morning that led to this conclusion, and that felt pretty good. But in my experience at this school, I would say, in all of my experience in education, you could divide kids into two categories, even though I hate to do this, but hear me out. There are kids who, when they encounter this authority and all of the, you know, threats of consequence that come with not doing what you're told to do, that react in one of two ways. Either they acquiesce, they comply, they conform, or they see that demand, that adult will with all these consequences being hurled at them, as a justification to turn it up, right? Because all it is another person threatening you. You say, oh, well, we're making young person aware of what the consequences will be. Those are threats. And you think about all of the emotional stress that's already there, that how that feels and how that looks to somebody who is in crisis. I can't even imagine how stressful that might be. And even while I was just expanding in the last minute on these two categories, I realized there's not just two categories. There's at least one more. And I really can't believe I forgot it, because it's the group that I'm trying to, through this podcast, invite more people into, where I think some people can just manage to stay above all of that. Osborne has talked about on the live show before his awareness that he was kind of playing this game where, yes, I do my work and I'm compliant, but you kind of know deep down that you're being subjected to a whole bunch of bullshit, so it's not really having a very significant impact on you. But that is also, in my experience, very rare. So let's focus on the two types, either compliance and conformity or rebellion. Either way you go, if this is the only mode of operation, right? Where you will do what I say or there'll be consequences. And in the interview that I heard with Ross Green that Steph did on Free Domain Radio, he talks about how to collaboratively solve problems with young people. And Plan A, which is the default for almost everybody, is the adult will is imposed and there'll be consequences if that will is not honored. Doesn't need to be explained, doesn't need to be justified. It's just that, you know, I'm bigger. And I was really happy to hear Dr. Green say the phrase, might makes right. I'm not happy about the embrace of that phrase, but I was happy to hear him use language that I've used a bunch of times in the past. Now, this goes nowhere, right? Because there is absolutely no concern being expressed for that young person, whatever the crisis is, whatever their needs are, in Plan A. So what he talks about is a Plan B, where there are three steps. And these three steps are about creating a win-win situation. Both people involved in the conflict or potential conflict wanting to get their needs met. And that might be an appropriate place for an adult to take charge, or at least in modeling a solution, or how to create a solution, or having a friggin' interest in a solution that is mutually beneficial. So the first step that Dr. Green talks about is gathering information. You know, why is this happening? Or why is this thing that I want to happen not happening? And the most common response, especially for a young child, I had an experience very similar to this recently, and I'll tell you about it, is I don't want to. That's what he says. So this is when people switch back to Plan A. Most parents will dip their little toes into Plan B, right? Why? What's wrong? You know, what's going on? But there's often a lot more, he says, to that than I just don't want to, you know? And maybe at that point you can shift to the second step, which is, you know, expressing an adult concern. You know, like, well, I think it's important. The example that he gives in the interview talks about brushing your teeth. And it's like, well, you know, it's important to me for reasons X, Y, and Z. We don't have to go into that. But, you know, showing that you are, wow, you know, a human being. Act like a human being. You know, I have needs too. I have worries too. And maybe that changes the dynamic of that interaction just enough to encourage a young person to provide just a little bit more feedback and information about what might be going on. I've also found that maybe prompting with some questions is an okay thing to do. Well, you know, what do you need? What's wrong? Is there something wrong with this or that? Or is there a fear? You know, I've even gone into experiences from my past. You know, when I was your age, I didn't want to do this because, you know, that it's a dialogue. Different situations might call for different approaches, but if it just has that Plan A dynamic to it, it is going nowhere good. Like, you can always get compliance one way or another. You know, I saw from my experience a lot of forceful compliance, physically aided compliance. Not a good thing. And not a relationship. The third step is actually brainstorming a solution where people express their needs and then they talk about, well, what can we do? And again, acting like a human, showing that, you know, I'm willing to put some time into this. And it's not just an arbitrary command. I remember at this school, some of the staff, like say Joey was supposed to clean his room. The staff command would be Joey, room. That's how you talk to a pet. There's not even a modicum of respect in that interaction. It almost seemingly intentionally. So when I heard him describing this, I was actually really satisfied and able to take, you know, from what was generally, while a very educational experience, mostly a negative, you know, part of my employment history, some pride in the fact that I had learned without any of this knowledge, without doing any reading, any research, just from feeling things out and kind of thinking like, you know, this is, geez, how I would like to be treated as a kid who had plenty of issues. You know, disciplinary, truancy, drugs, alcohol, passive aggression. I think that was one of the things that made me somewhat good at this job is that, you know, being 23, 24 years old and, you know, having pretty fresh memories of being a troubled teen and being able to say, you know, if I was in this situation, here's kind of what I would be looking for. So I would say I need to a young person, I would say I need blank. So I'm not somebody who's threatening you. I'm not somebody who is more powerful than you, because either that meant acquiescence, which leads to resentment, which in this environment led to sneaking, which could often be very dangerous. I need blank. Or on the other hand, if it's not acquiescence, if it's not compliance, it's turning up the conflict, which again could also lead to a situation that is unsafe. So I would say I need blank because, like, you deserve a reason for why I need this. Even though when all is said and done, you know, you could be restrained, you could be punished, you could be drugged, you could be sent someplace worse. Most of these kids had jail hanging over them. So every staff member there always had a fine repertoire of threats. But again, that's just escalating the situation even more because it causes stress. And another thing that Dr. Green points out is that a lot of these things are small problems. They can be tabled. They don't have to be dealt with right now. Or they can be dealt with using Plan B in a proactive way, right? Because it's not good if there's already conflict, Plan B is hard. So he talks about the emergency Plan B of, like, all right, this is already going on. It's already escalating. Maybe there's other people involved who are already cranking up the stress of this situation. So now I'll jump in with Plan B, and it might be too late. Like I said, no positive way forward without going back. And sometimes that might mean, no, this is not a conflict that we can solve right now. And as long as nobody's safety is in jeopardy, maybe what we need is some space. Because most of this stuff was just about compliance. And I'm working towards an example that happened to me recently, but I'll come back to that in a minute. So the problem with not being proactive and everything, I think we talked about this in the Carrots and Sticks roundtable with Mark and Ian from Free Talk Live. And Osborne said, this is hard. Like, it's not an excuse to not do this because it's hard. Like, this is parenting. This is the hardest thing. And I only have a glimpse of what this might be like, you know, from my childhood experience and my experience in these residential settings. You know, where we're making a lot of the same requests, or unfortunately, a lot of the times demands of young people. And I worked with kids who were as young as 8 to adults who were as old as 20 in this school. And, you know, whether we're talking about parenting or what I did, there is a real need for an empirical approach here. Now, this is at a time in my life where I could not have told you what empiricism even meant. But I knew that we could learn from past events, past activities, past trips in a van or wherever. And I did a lot of outdoor education stuff too. That after 3 or 4 events or trips or whatever, you could get a pretty good idea of what the buffet of conflicts, student to student or student to staff, might be. And you could take the proactive approach of saying, we are going to blank. I need, today I would add to that, avoiding saying things like you must or you should. I think at the time, another thing that I probably did then that I wouldn't do now is using language like my expectation is. I would say, I need blank because I really need blank and blank to not happen so we can blank. You can do a Q&A period after this. Maybe it would take 5 minutes. And I certainly wasn't the only person who worked at the school who figured this out. A lot of people ran these groups before an activity. Sometimes there was 10 people that we would have to do this with. So when it's just 1 or 2 kids, I would think that that is something that could be executed relatively smoothly. And doing this proactive approach also prevents things from building up to that explosive point. Now, some of you might be saying, Brett, you're kind of talking in this language of a behavior manager, which ironically was actually my job title at one point prior to taking the teaching position that I've been discussing at this school. And I don't mean to do that, but the more I reflect on this time period, the more I think I'm thinking in that language that I was supposed to be thinking in then. This was a job, like I said before, for on the residential side anyway, being what was called a line staff or a residential counselor was like the entry-level position at the school. It was a job for anybody. So a lot of people were just there for paychecks. And it was a working for a paycheck kind of mindset that permeated through this place. Unfortunately. People who don't really, really, really like spending time with kids shouldn't be in a place like this, period. And that being said, I think it would be great if, you know, along that same vein, if adults who didn't really want to be parents would stop having children in this blind, irrational submission to some biological cue that says, oh, I'm 32, I should get married and have kids now because that's what, you know, we do in here in society. And I did catch myself just a little bit talking in this like efficiency language, this managing behavior kind of language. But if two people are having a relationship, right, and one is 35 and one is 4, I think that the person who's 35 needs to be doing a little bit more of the thinking and the planning in that relationship than the 4-year-old. It's kind of just the dynamic of that. And obviously, the health of a relationship has a lot to do with the person who is doing the thinking and the planning, or a majority of the thinking and the planning, their ability to prevent conflicts. And that means dealing with issues in real time, dealing with issues proactively. Because as Dr. Ross Green said, you know, when you do this plan B, in a proactive way, it seems like you would always be able to get to the third step, which is the collaborative problem solving. It is the brainstorming of a solution, showing the young person that you're willing to invest time and energy into solving this problem, and you're not just being an authoritarian. When we're not proactive, and problems build up, see plenty of this in the old adult world, well, it tends to, one conflict about one thing tends to snowball into a conflict about many things where you don't do this and you don't do this and I've told you to do this, 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 and this, and you won't do this. I mean, we see that in relationships. I mean, for years, when I was growing up, I thought my parents got divorced because of disagreements about how many things should be in the dishwasher when the dishwasher gets run and what the heat setting should be and should we do heated dry or should they just air dry on their own and what should the thermostat be set up. People who will fight about anything except the real issue, right? And that kind of goes back to what we're talking about. The real issues can never be addressed because they're really uncomfortable a lot of the times. And they require introspection. They require honesty. Self-examination, that's not for everybody. And I will certainly speak from my own experience, it's been a plenty hard thing for me to do sometimes. And more recently, for me, even though I will tell you I'm certainly no master of this yet, this is one of the ways in which I've found NVC, nonviolent communication, to be very helpful. And it might not always show up in my podcast, it might not always show up in the live show or the outward interactions that I have with other people, but one of the things that I saw as incredibly valuable within NVC was kind of rewriting the programming language, the thinking. And I was talking to somebody recently about what I would call a cognitive distortion. There's several different types of cognitive distortions, but one that I had struggled with for a long time is kind of black and white, all or nothing thinking. And even learning to stop and think in a different language can really help with some of these relationships that we've been talking about in this show so far. Because so many people in these, you know, adult to child, adult to teen relationships are just kind of going with the flow. Yeah, I'm the authoritarian. I demand compliance. Of course, there's going to be embarrassing or demeaning consequences if my demand for compliance is not honored by the person who is supposed to be, as society orders, submissive to my will, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. It's always like, why won't this person do my will? And it's never like, why is this my will? And this would be a good place to try and do one of the strategies that I think is helpful outside of what I've covered so far from Dr. Green's work is we'll call it like a word exchange. And this has a lot to do with metacognition, thinking about how we think and then making changes where they might be necessary. So in the whole black and white, all or nothing, the words we use are must. So this is helpful. One more thing. This is helpful in our relationships with ourselves, but this also might be helpful if, you know, we're having these interactions with young people. So we think in must, should, have to, can't, ought to, all, always, never, none. And to try and change just some of these words around can really help relieve some of the sense of urgency and the subsequent tension that might not even be real or necessary. But there's all these in parenting, in what I did, there were all of these supposed tos, have tos, musts, and it puts a lot of pressure on the person who's supposed to be in that submissive position, but the pushback that you're getting from them is like, yeah, I don't really have a feeling like your authority here is legitimate. I often think that that perceived tension and urgency of the authority figure that translates into these musts and have tos and or else's for the young person is really just the result of the programming into our own thinking through that kind of language. Must can be changed to prefer. Should can be changed to choose to. And don't talk in absolutes. That really closes off all kinds of possibilities. Now, having a better command of that programming language has also helped me better evaluate some of my beliefs. And I think this would work for parents too, because some of the beliefs might be completely irrational. Or they might just be conforming to societal expectations for parenting that if they really evaluated, they'd find don't make much sense and aren't in the best interest of them as parents or of their children. So here's something that I see a bunch, right? You've certainly, most of you have had this experience once where there's a child, right? And they're behaving in a way that is, as far as the parent is concerned, who knows that you are observing this interaction, that behavior is less than optimal in their eyes. So they try to do some kind of redirection, and then they kind of give you this frustrated look that asks for your sympathy, like, geez, these kids, you know, who can figure them out? Too bad we were born as fully grown adults so we can just have, you know, no idea what they could possibly want or why they won't follow instructions. You know that look? I mean, like, oh, that's the sound that that look makes. I think what that shows us, I hope you know what I'm talking about there, is that a lot of the time we're not responding to the behavior of a child. We're not responding to the actual event that leads to this feeling of a need for intervention or discipline. People respond to their beliefs about that behavior or about that event. So in that moment, what precedes the look that the parent who is having a problem, quote unquote, with their child shoots to you is like, I'm going to look like some kind of asshole here. If I can't control a four-year-old, I look weak, I look stupid, I look like an ineffective parent. This is not okay. And like I said, a lot of times, those beliefs are just, you know, things that have been passed down from generations prior that really are pretty unenlightened and not the best way, as far as a win-win situation is concerned, to deal with whatever the issue is. So This was one of the things that I wanted to do with Mark, and I just forgot when he was on the show, is to kind of walk through this process of we have something happens to activate beliefs, right? The child, your son, your daughter, your student, whatever, they do something. So then, after whatever the event is, beliefs happen. If those beliefs are just, you know, passed through that process without evaluation, well, they have consequences. They have consequences for you, and they have consequences for the young person involved. So one way to turn it around is to, at the belief phase, when those beliefs are activated, to question them. Why do I think this is the right thing to do? Is this rational? Does this make sense? Is this in everybody's best interest? You know, you're taking a minute to question and, if necessary, dispute an irrational belief by turning those beliefs into questions and then those questions into answers, which can lead to an effective new way of thinking about that problem. This is something that has been incredibly helpful for me just with self-talk, with things that don't even in the moment involve another human being. But on last Thursday's live show, Osborne and I were talking, and I described my Thanksgiving as a very placid experience, right? Because I took none of the opportunities. Like, we're post-election, there's a lot of things in the news, a lot of hot topics that lead to hot talk, right? At the Vannat family holidays. And I abstained from all of that, but there was one moment where there was just a little bit of tension. My brother's daughter, my niece, is six. And we all got together to eat. It was both my brothers, their kids, my brother Adam's significant other, my mother, and my uncle, who is just kind of, he was my mother's brother, and he lives locally and is single, and he's just kind of there. And I've talked about him on the show before. He's just somebody that everybody has to, tolerate. And because, you know, it's this family thing for my mom. And just if you've never heard me tell family stories before, they had quite an interesting childhood, this mom side of the family. And, when I was young, when I was growing up, my mom was often, you know, very reactive, hysterical, or emotionally distant. And there wasn't much in between, right? There was either like no real authentic concern for anyone or crisis mode. And, you know, I mean, that was a situation that I escaped as soon as I could. In the meantime, my parents got divorced, like right after I think I left to go to college, and my dad was gone and my mom went to therapy. And, today she is a very strong person who I respect very much. And it was like one of the, I would say, the most significant transformations of a human being that I've ever seen in my life. But she has this brother who had all the same childhood experiences as her. And you can see exactly what she would be like at late 50s, early 60s, if she had not done the work that she did. Or, you know, you get a really good idea. I shouldn't say exactly, but you get a really good idea of what she would be like and maybe what she was like. So he's not an extremely pleasant person and doesn't have any sort of, concern for other people unless it creates an opportunity to feign concern, to, you know, yell at somebody. And people just kind of don't take it seriously and tolerate it. But my brother got upset at one point because his niece asked to leave the table, and she had been sitting with us for maybe 10 minutes. And he said, yeah, all right, see ya. And she went in the other room and started playing. The uncle pipes up and he says, do these kids ever hear the word no? You know, my brother spoke up and said something like, everyone can be a perfect parent when they're talking about somebody else's kids. You know, and he said, you don't need to concern yourself with it. She's done. She's on to something else. You know? So then you start thinking about, like, why? But for me, there was this moment where, like, where is she going? Quite honestly, there was this moment, like, why did she only sit here for 10 minutes? And there's this brief last, less than 2 minutes, this flare up at the table of, like, oh, she should sit with us because it's Thanksgiving. Well, I mean, first of all, Thanksgiving is bullshit. It's no different. It's no more special than any other, you know, Sunday dinner or whatever. So that's a completely invalid argument. That was the exact length of time that she usually sits at the table, the time that she takes to eat her food, and then she goes off and does what she's interested in doing. There's no benefit in real life for her to sit there any longer than that for anybody. Except maybe for people in the past who complied with this arbitrary diktat that they sit at the table and listen to adult talk while probably pretty much ignoring them for as long as 45 minutes to an hour. Like maybe the older generation had to do. And that's a common transference from one generation to the next where the older says to the younger, I demand that you be treated as poorly as I was when I was a child in the 50s and the 60s or whenever. For some reason, I get up and I go into the other room and I say to her, what's wrong? You know, why? Maybe would you come back and sit with us for 10 minutes? Now, when I got up and walked to where she was, I felt like for just a brief moment without thinking about this, I felt like the only positive outcome for this situation was to have her come back to the table and sit with us. And then when I got there and I sat down with her, she said, I don't want to. And she didn't really want to elaborate on it any more than that. So I got back up and, you know, I talked to her for like a minute and I got back up and I walked back to the table and I sat down. And, you know, the outrage on my uncle's part was very visible. And I could see that my mother was like a little bit upset about it. Right. That, like, she had done a ton of work, and it was important to her that my niece sat at the table. And I said, you know, there's two things we could do. I could go and I could pick her up, bring her back to the table, force her to sit there till we're all done eating. So, and then sarcastically, I said, so she can always look back fondly at this memory of the time where people forced her to sit at the table until everyone was done, because it was important to us, because it was Thanksgiving for reasons that she couldn't possibly comprehend. Or, you know, maybe we could say to ourselves, since we can't control anybody else, you know, certainly not what they think or how they feel, how could we be the kinds of people that a six-year-old would want to sit with for 45 minutes? Now, the truth is that those are both extremes, both kind of hyperbolic, and I was saying them in jest, maybe partially in an effort to diffuse a slightly uncomfortable moment in an otherwise pleasant evening. But the real way, the third way, I think the most beneficial way for everyone involved, is to work on that relationship. And to do so in a moment where there isn't this perceived sense of urgency, where an entire family is waiting at a table to see if I will return with an errant child. In that moment, there's probably not a real productive way forward. If she's already made the decision, she's already left the table, she's already gotten permission, which she asked for from her dad, is it okay if I go do something else now? I don't know why I got up, honestly, and went and asked her why. And I think after sitting there for just, you know, less than a minute, I knew that she wasn't coming back. I knew that she didn't want to come back. So what am I going to do? Manipulate her in the moment into coming back? And I left. I walked away. But I think that the working on the relationship part correlates with what we were talking about earlier, Dr. Ross Green's proactive plan B. When it's not in that moment where there's all this perceived urgency and tension, to inquire thoughtfully, what is it about dinner? What is it about family dinner that makes you want to get away after 10 minutes? And, you know, it might take a little time to work out the language and the best way to ask those questions. But right then and there, when I found myself in that situation, I could see and feel the difficulty of trying to maybe, I don't know, get what my mom wanted. I mean, my uncle is going to complain if there isn't crushed red pepper on the table. If the bread didn't come from Beach Pea Bakery in Kittery, Maine, he's going to find a thing to complain about. So maybe it was like, can we create a situation where Alex, my niece, and my mom are both happy? But I saw that even without all of the, emotion and anger, where that plan A threat of consequences is usually inserted. And I would never do anything like that. You know me better that I'm not going to say, you know, you come back to the table or else this happens. No, that's, I don't even need to say that to you, that I wouldn't say that to her. You know that. But imagine like the situation that we talked about at the beginning of the show, where there's all of this anger and the momentum of that already built up, and then trying to insert that threat and being so confused to think that that could ever have a positive outcome. You know, there were so many events over the course of the last 4 years, 6 years, where I was really disappointed how they passed without notice or without significant change. Because I think when I started listening to Free Talk Live and Complete Liberty podcast in 2006, and it was very easy to identify some of the trends that were taking place in society, I said, when this happens, there will be this I told you so moment, right? Where everyone will see when Barack Obama gets elected and Gitmo doesn't close, that people will wake up. When the NDAA passes after Obama talks about government transparency and, you know, a return to civil liberties, people will wake up. Libertarians will have that I told you so moment with everybody else, where they turn and they come to us and they say, you were right. Folks, that moment for most people is not coming. Because outside the realm of reason, outside the realm of critical thinking, in which almost all mainstream political thought takes place, that moment can't happen. And the truth is, we don't want it. Because it's not about, oh, great, now we're all on the same page. Now we have a mutual understanding of, you know, important principles and their implications in real life. It's about, I win, you lose, I told you so. Politics provides such a fertile ground for that kind of thinking and those kinds of interactions, win-lose. So I have since stopped holding my breath for that moment where I am declared the winner. We take that from the political to the personal, and the best way to get away from rationality is to crank up emotion. So you have all of this tension in a family, between parents and a child, between siblings, in a relationship, like a romantic relationship, where the tension and the emotion and the anger and the resentment is just being cranked up. And then there's going to be this punishment, right? This punishment, when it just comes too much to bear, when the parent gets to the end of their rope, all other options exhausted, all other routes explored thoroughly, according to them, there is going to be this tough love, I told you so moment, where you lose, and oops, I also lose. And then we start the whole process over again.
It's not just embarrassing me, it's embarrassing them too, and I hope it does embarrass them as much as it's embarrassing me.
Thank you for listening, and take care.
Okay, what you're about to watch here is what we might call basic, seamless, proactive Plan B. The purpose in showing you this is to mostly just show you what the three ingredients of Plan B would look like with nothing at all going wrong. So what you should be looking for here is the three basic ingredients. You're looking first for the empathy step. This is where the adult is trying to gather information so as to clarify the kid's concern or perspective on the unsolved problem that they're trying to work on. Second, the define the problem step. This is where the adult is trying to communicate their concern or perspective on the same unsolved problem. And last, you're looking for the invitation, which is where child and teacher are brainstorming solutions so as to try to come up with one that will address the concerns of each other. Let's see what that looks like.
Charlie, I've noticed sometimes when I'm teaching that you make noises. What's up?
I like to drum with my pencil.
Yes, I've noticed that you like to drum with your pencil. What do you like about that?
I just have to keep my hands moving. It helps me.
Oh, I see. So you feel like you need to keep your hands moving, and one way to do that is by drumming. Well, how does that help you?
It keeps me from talking.
I see. And that would be worse?
Yeah. I used to get in trouble a lot for talking. Drumming is better.
Oh, well, I understand. Is there anything else about the drumming you want me to know about?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, see, the thing is, the noise of your drumming is distracting to me and the kids around you. Sometimes when I'm teaching, I forget what I'm going to say next because I'm paying attention to your drumming. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
All right. So, I wonder if there's any way we can keep your hands moving and keep you from talking so that you don't distract me or the kids around you. Do you have any ideas?
I don't know.
Well, that's all right. We're not in a rush. Let's think about that for a minute. How could we solve this problem?
I could type on my book instead of the metal desk or something else that doesn't make as much noise.
Well, you could tap on your book instead. We could try that. I wonder if there's anything else that you could tap on that would be even softer.
I have that squishy thing that everybody wanted me to squeeze. If I tapped on that, it'd make even less noise in the book.
I remember that squishy ball that you have. Do you think that would work for you?
Uh-huh.
Well, I think that would work for me, too. Why don't we try that? We'll see how loud it is. And we'll give it a try, and if it doesn't work, we'll keep talking about it until we can come up with something that does work, okay?
Okay.
Okay, now, if you're thinking that was fast, you'd be right. Plan B isn't usually that fast. The empathy step, trying to get the kid's concern on the table, usually takes much more time than that. It looked like the kid had a pretty simple, basic concern. That was fast. The adult got their concern on the table very quickly as well. Often adults aren't actually all that clear about what their concerns are. So that can take a while. And thinking of solutions and thinking about whether they're realistic and mutually satisfactory, that too can take a while. So what you just saw is not necessarily what your goal is. The goal isn't speed. The goal is do a really good job of getting the kids' concern on the table. You're not interested in speed here. You want to have your aha moment in the empathy step, that moment at which you say, aha, finally, I understand what his concern or perspective is on that unsolved problem. In the define the problem step, you're not done with the define the problem step until you feel like you've done a good job of making sure the kid understands what your concern or perspective is on the same unsolved problem. And in the invitation, that can take a while. It can take quite some time to brainstorm potential solutions, think about them, project them into the future so as to evaluate their likely outcomes, think about whether they're mutually satisfactory. And you probably also noticed that Plan B always ends with an agreement to return to Plan B if the first solution doesn't quite get the job done. What didn't you see while you were watching Plan B? Well, number one, I made a point of emphasizing that that was proactive Plan B, not emergency Plan B. Emergency Plan B would take place as the kid is in the middle of tapping his pencil in the middle of a lesson yet again. And while that could be in your repertoire, it's actually not the best timing, and it's a lot harder, especially in terms of timing. You've got a bunch of other kids sitting in the classroom. What else didn't you see? You didn't see a kid losing tickets. You didn't see a kid getting his name put on the board. You didn't see a kid having a check mark put next to his name. You didn't see him getting rewarded. You didn't see him getting punished. Why not? That's not collaborative problem solving. None of those interventions would help the teacher clarify the kid's concerns and finally, at long last, get a good handle on what's really going on with the pencil tapping. None of those interventions would help the kid know what the adult's concern is. None of those interventions would have student and teacher working together so as to come up with a solution now that both sets of concerns are finally well clarified, coming up with solutions that would address the concerns of both parties. If you're thinking collaborative problem solving is very different from what you're doing now, you might be right. If you're thinking that collaborative problem solving takes a lot of time, it doesn't take anywhere near as much time as checks, losing tickets, punishment, interrupting the class for the same problem that's been coming up over and over and over again. Collaborative problem solving saves time.
And one of my biggest adversaries was a woman who had been the dorm supervisor, the residential supervisor for this campus on one half of the week. But she had pretty much been given like the title of being in charge of the whole program, being in charge of the whole campus. So like she could have her hands in the clinical stuff. She could have her hands in the educational stuff and ran the whole show residentially. And it was her methods that had programmed the kids that I encountered when I first went there to teach into these, you know, it was either robotic or explosive. And like I said before, very, very little in between. And I found this very unsettling. I said to the people who were involved in the clinical work, that was like the real clinical work, not just the drugs, who I got the sense really did care about their jobs, this one gentleman especially, that if these kids are going back to the world that's out there, this behavior is incredibly dangerous. So this is the compliance, right? It's either rebellion or compliance, and that was all we saw, and nothing very healthy in the middle. So Patty, I didn't really see as like a hothead or a bad person, or somebody that I would describe as the kind of person who shouldn't be around kids. Because in the beginning, when I was just getting my feet wet at this place, you know, I was working pretty closely with her because she was like the top dog of this whole program, this whole campus. And I found her to be a likable person. I thought she really cared about these kids, but tough love and, you know, widespread consequences for the behavior of the very few was kind of the operating procedure that I encountered when I first went there. And she left that program to go to a different part of the school after that. But I got the sense that she was sort of watching and questioning from afar when this psychologist and I really began to try and revamp the entire program away from what she had spent years creating and what had, you know, had so many, what had received so many accolades from other people in the school. But people were also at the very top levels, administration wise, were interested in seeing if what I wanted to do would work. And, you know, I left that school in 2004. A friend of mine actually took the teaching job there. Unfortunately, I haven't kept up on it. You know, I knew this whole newspaper project that I started fizzled shortly after I left. And, you know, it wasn't much longer after that that I kind of lost interest and was kind of moving on with life anyway. So that's one story. And obviously, I had a staff supporting me, but we did a lot of great things. We changed the whole curriculum. We started a school newspaper that we ran out of this campus, and I gave all the kids jobs. We changed the whole disciplinary structure, the whole environment of what the kids were allowed to do and what they were allowed to see to try and undo some of that robot behavior that was so frightening. And one of my teacher's assistants, his name was Brent, one of my least favorite names. He was a very nice guy, but everybody always would mix us up and call me Brent, and that was particularly annoying. But Brent really had a tough go of it because the kids would shit all over him all the time. And it was entirely because of how he presented. I mean, we were in a whole building, and I would hear, like, from a couple rooms away, I would hear him say, "Come on, guys, don't! No! Stop!" You know, and he projected a lot of weakness. This is a big topic in parenting today, isn't it? So there's always this thing that gets raised, just to step out of my residential school teaching experience for a minute, of, are we being too permissive? You know, it's because kids today can get away with anything. Well, I'm not in favor of being weak or being a pushover, right? Because the reason why I was effective when I would go at these conflicts with kids as I need blank because blank. And most of the time, not all the time, kids would honor those requests and those needs is because of how I presented myself. Now, I will say that at 24 years old, 25 years old, in this job, I was also learning quite a bit about acting because that's what I was doing. But kids understand self-confidence and assertiveness and self-esteem. This was at a time in my life where every day I went into work, I was anxious, I was scared, I was responsible for what happened there. It caused me a tremendous amount of stress. I was in a, you know, on the personal side, I was in a bad relationship. I was drinking way too much. I would come into work hungover. And that was a, you know, like alcohol and drug abuse at this school. You know, I could think of like 40 people who worked there who went to AA. Because that it was a stressful job, and if that stress wasn't processed, that was a common outlet, drugs and alcohol. So I acted because I was in charge. Every morning I would walk in there, I would have my head up, I would make eye contact with people. I, you know, carried myself well physically, I was very well built at the time, I had a lot of keys, which makes you look important. And, you know, I would go and I would engage people. I would smile no matter how shitty I was on the inside. I had this exterior presentation that, you know, apparently earned a lot of respect. In retrospect, I can't believe I got away with it. You know, because I was not in good shape in a lot of ways at that time. And it makes me think, man, you know, if I really had that confidence, if I really had that self-esteem, you know, that turned out as this self-assertiveness, if all of that was genuine, man, I wonder how effective I could have been in that job. But fake or not, the kids spoke that language. And it wasn't about like being a hotshot or being, you know, a tough guy or anything like that. That was not the presentation. But it was just like, you know, I think back and I can picture that every day when I walked in there or every time that I had a conflict, I would act like I knew what I was doing and where I was going. And I wish it had been real, because there is still a takeaway, you know, even though that projection was kind of coming from nowhere genuine, it is true that having positive and productive relationships with other people has, you know, a ton to do with the relationship, the quality of the relationship that you have with yourself. And let me just be clear, I'm certainly not suggesting that faking those things in lieu of actually having, you know, confidence and self-esteem is in any way adequate. And I probably, if I had stayed there another year in the condition that I was in, with that facade, I probably would have cracked. And it was immediately after I left this job in 2004 that I started a pretty thorough period of self-examination that I would say helped me quite a bit in the long run, despite a few bumps in the road. But topic for another time.